Hi, Small Subjects listeners. We want to hear from you. Click on the link on the blog where we post photos from each episode. www.boxdioramas.com/smallsubjects or on our social media posts and comment on anything we've said in this or any episode or pose a question you'd like to hear us answer.
There's no time limit, but please try to focus your comments because we'd love to include them in full on the show. Thanks.
Welcome to Small Subjects, Big Ideas About Miniatures and Modeling. I'm Jim DeRogatis in Chicago.
And I'm Barry Biediger in Salt Lake City.
Hey, Barry, how you doing?
Not too bad. How are you?
I know you're a little stressed out. You got a lot on your plate.
A little bit, yeah.
We'll talk about, but it's a good kind of stress. We'll talk about it later. First, Barry, we have a bona fide scoop. To use a word from my one of my other professions, journalism here. We have been chasing this story for some time about a very exciting happening in Las Vegas, the birth of a museum education center devoted to miniatures, Verco's Vault. We talked about it a little bit when you went out there for a class.
Yeah.
And we've been chasing the elusive Gary Sparks, collector and patron and Gandalf-looking fellow, who is the force behind this museum. We didn't really speak to him. He's waiting for the big opening to give us an interview. But we talked to two of the four-member team that is making this happen. Penny Meyer has been on the show before, fantastic artist, a good friend of ours. David Higgins is from the fantasy world, and I guess the first lieutenant, along with Gary and his assistant, making this museum and educational center happen. And I'm really proud to have him on the show.
Yeah, that was a great chat. They were fun to talk to.
Let's dive in. I started by asking them to give us the lowdown on what is happening in Las Vegas.
Verco's Vault is a fantasy miniatures museum in Las Vegas. It houses over 16,000 pieces across more than 160 artists. It's a collection that's been amassed by a collector who's now public. His name's Gary Sparks. And he's taken it upon himself to create this museum here in Las Vegas.
That is so excellent. And Barry has been down there.
I have. I took a class down there in December with Mateo.
That's right.
Yeah. I can't remember how to pronounce his last name, so I'm going to slaughter it.
Don't put me on the spot.
Diamati?
Diamati or something like that, right? So, sorry.
And sorry, Mateo.
David, how did you get involved in this world of miniatures?
Well, in the world of miniatures or in this
Let's start with you in general first. I understand you do some 3D design.
Yeah, I guess it really starts the first time I ever saw miniatures on a table. Which is during my elder brother's D&D game in the mid-ish 80s or so. And they had little miniatures on there, and I was infatuated from then. At some point in time, you know, I started painting them like early 90s, you know. So I've been around for a while doing that. I never did it professionally, other than if you can, I guess selling them to my brother, you know, I would paint them for my So other than that, but he didn't charge very much, or I didn't charge very much to him anyway.
Anyways, but sibling discount.
Right. Yeah. 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 It paid for, at some point in time, it paid for, you know, gas money.
Gotcha.
But I've been painting miniatures, you know, ever since I can remember, really. So,
okay.
How many years ago did you meet Gary?
And then when I started painting professionally about 10 years ago, I just put my stuff up on eBay, and I was traveling. I happened to be in Jackson Hole at the time with my family on vacation. And then I just heard ka-ching, 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 ka-ching. And that was Gary buying everything that I had put on eBay.
Wow. So Gary was a collector and an enthusiast.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yes.
Was and is. Yeah.
So that like really energized me. And I just started doing more and painting more. And then I reached out to Gary more and more and seeing if he would like my stuff. And at some point in time, I realized what I was a part of, that it wasn't just me that he was buying from. It was, you know, a lot of people.
Mm.
And while this is like the newest, this is the very exciting news for right now, I think what a lot of people don't realize is this has been going on for quite some time.
Gary's been a patron of the art form.
Yes.
Excellent. Now, so how did Verko's Vault come about? The idea of opening a museum for the public to celebrate this art.
Well, he's obviously always had an interest in the collection and building the collection and the art and all of that. At one point, it was really just for him and his and the artists themselves, because he likes to have the artists out and visit with them and have them to be able to have them see their peers' work in front of them all together like that is it's pretty inspiring, you know. But so at some point in time, he realized that maybe not inviting the world into his home to see the collection, and rather put the collection in a place to where the world can see it, makes more sense. There's been various ideas along the way about how he's going to implement that. And where we're at right now is the museum.
At which you guys built from we're scratch, right?
Right now, it's actually being built out right now.
There's drywall going up on the walls currently, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it encompasses two buildings on Dean Martin Boulevard in Las Vegas. We have a admin building and basically how that came about was that these buildings were there for quite some time, and for whatever legal reasons, they weren't really available on the market. And this area doesn't have a lot of this available. And Gary was driving by one day, and finally a for sale sign went up, and he got very lucky on the very first day and was able to purchase these buildings. And so they basically were a shell with dirt floors waiting to have a vision. And he got together with an architect, and they implemented his vision. The first building was completed, I think, in November. And that's what we're using for the admin building. And then we've temporarily got our classroom set up in there. And then they are currently doing the infrastructure, putting the walls up, all the conduit, et cetera, to finish the museum building, which is two stories. The bottom story will have a teaching center and a welcome center and a store. We eventually will have a product store, and then two gaming rooms. And the upstairs will be the actual museum part, which will have a theater, which will have introductory videos going and movies about what it is that this is all about. And then we'll have the display area that will house the collection itself. And then we also will have a giant walkthrough diorama, which will house some of his collection in a dynamic situation.
Wow. Wow. Very cool. Ambitious.
I would say 25,000 square feet for the museum is the total. So the walkthrough diorama is not just it's 3,000 square feet of diorama that we have to produce.
Wow. This is a life size or still miniature?
Oh, it's heroic scale. It's miniature scale.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or, you know, at gaming size.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Penny, we've had you on the podcast before, celebrating your art and your attitude and the education you do. So this is a question really for both of you, Penny and David. How did, I gather Gary's collection and first love was fantasy, his entry point, that end of the world. Penny, of course, you are a regular attendee at the historical shows literally around the world. Is this a first coming together of these two worlds for the museum?
I would say so. I'm learning a lot because the focus is on fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Gary, we had a lot of talks about historical figures, and he does have historical figures in his collection. It's just not the primary focus at this point. We'll, you know, eventually probably branch out a little bit develop a more, you know, a more historical angle to some of the collection. But right now, the fantasy and the gaming figures are really the focus. And so it is a learning experience for me. And I have to say that looking at these figures, you know, all I can say that would sum it up is I wish I would have had these figures to paint when I was starting out.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, honestly, I really enjoy doing the historical part because I like doing the research and stuff like that. But, you know, back in the 80s when I started doing it, and, you know, and you guys too, we had pretty static figures. They weren't mm-hmm. exciting at all, you know, and creating dioramas, you had to pretty much be a person that could do conversions or sculpting or whatever. The figures that are available now, especially on the fantasy side, are so spectacular. They really, like every one of them I look at, and, oh, wow, I would love to do something with that, you know, but I still am drawn to my historical pieces. But, you know, eventually I've got a few fantasy pieces that I've been working on slowly, but at any rate, it's a real learning curve for me. I had no idea. Let me give you an example of how surprising this whole thing was to me. You know, I met just slowly but surely, I've met three or four other figure artists here in Las Vegas, and they predominantly do the historical stuff. And so there was like three, maybe four at one time, and we would get together and paint. I had no idea how many fantasy artists were here until we attended the Las Vegas Open gaming convention in January. It was shocking to me. I mean, I would say I met probably at least 50 artists here.
Yeah. Yeah.
That you know, are here in Las Vegas and painting and wanting groups of people to paint with. And there are gaming stores where they do meet and everything, but I think that what Verkos Vault is going to be offering for them is going to be a little more fulfilling in the end. But it is very impressive, the audience that the gaming community has. I am extremely impressed with it.
You know, David, on our podcast, we've interviewed some of the best fantasy painters in the world, and we see them at the historical shows, and it's a bridge we've been attempting to build at historical shows for a very long time, and with the podcast. So it's nice to see all of these artists coming, because it's the same spirit that unites everyone, whether you're painting a Balrog or a Brit imperialist soldier. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it's all fantasy actually, because it's historical. It's not something that we can't just, if we were to go dress up in these costumes, right. And what would we be doing, but playing out of fantasy, you know?
Sure. Sure.
So like, for me, it's all the same. And, and a lot of the fantasy figures are inspired by history.
Mm-hmm.
So even, you know, when I'm designing figures myself, you know, I try to take a lot of my inspiration from history rather than, you know, just make something up necessarily, because I think that's more fulfilling it helps tell the story.
Yeah, well, the way a real barbarian swung a battle axe or a broadsword is going to be the same way that your figure is doing it, even if she is an invented person.
Yeah, especially that would be the hook, at least. But we while we do primarily focus on fantasy figures, you know, if this takes off, then maybe we'll get a hangar and we'll fill that up with facilities.
Well, I tell you, Barry and I talked about the show about Virkos once when he was down for that painting class, and I'm going to put in a plug for you. You need to have a little room off to the side for box dioramas.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, we've talked about it. Yeah. But, you know, the box dioramas have a bit of a challenge in display in that you have to stop and take the time to, you know, to look in a small window.
Yeah.
And also the space that they take up. However, you know, I have ideas on how we can remedy that and at a minimum have maybe a rotating area that focuses on at least one box diorama, you know, at a time, and we can rotate them in and out. And then that way, you know, we're not taking up a lot of space. But I do feel that a box diorama is an excellent way to tell a story, and people need to be introduced to them. So we'll eventually have, if not especially displays, but we'll have some kind of focus on box diorama. Yeah.
Well, this is, you know, I mean, they originate in museums, you know, as you know, the Thorn Rooms in the Chicago Art Institute and other dioramas. And, you know, when you look at the roots of fantasy modeling, David, there's guys like Spencer Van Gulik and Shep Payne were doing fantasy boxes in the 70s and 80s and really kind of paving the way. There was a fantastic magazine that one of the founding godfathers of World Expo and the whole historical miniatures world, Philip Stearns, had a magazine for two decades called Campaigns that celebrated military miniatures. But there were six or eight issues of Fantasy Offshoot really early on. I don't know if you've ever seen them. I managed to collect them all on eBay and from collectors who took pity on me, spending, you know, $35 on a magazine that was out of print 20 years ago. But it's fascinating to see what they were doing early on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the entire community is evolving mm-hmm. from them, right? And it's not just a hobby. We're not just coloring anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just 3D coloring. The caliber of artists that have been generated by our community, I think, is now rivaling. It's on par with the general art community now.
Sure.
With we understand, and it's taken. I mean, if you look at through the history of miniatures, you look at what those early Golden Demons pieces were like and compared to what is now. And the thing is the people that are runners up would have all got Golden Demons 20 years ago, you know, nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So like that's where we're at, where the whole field has developed since then.
Oh, right? Absolutely. Yeah.
And in such an incredible way.
Yeah.
We've watched that happen on the historical side as well.
Mm-hmm,
yeah. But I honestly think that it's due to the patronage of the collectors that has really driven that. Because as you know, I was a commissioned artist myself, and I always say that if I didn't know that it wasn't possible to put more time into it, I would not put more time into it. I still have to pay for my kids' karate classes and the car note and everything else.
Sure.
Time's money. So like, if I'm not going to be able to put more hours into it because I can't find a buyer, then why I can't do it. But that for me, it was really just knowing that I could just keep going and keep going and keep trying and keep pushing and knowing that, and then meeting that, mm-hmm. you know, that's, I think it's driven not just myself, but I think it's driven over 160 artists, and then all the people that they inspire too.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
You know,
well, that's where I wanted to go next. I want to hear about the educational aspect of what you guys are doing, because already you've had some fantastic artists come and teach classes.
Well, we want to do more than just workshops for sure down the road. Right now it's what we can handle because of our,
right.
you know, we're in the process of building the museum.
Yeah.
So while we plan on doing, we have many more workshops, scheduled for the future. We can give you a list also.
Mm.
And we continue to plan more. We have further plans to to start an artist in residence program where we'll invite artists to come and stay. They'll be put up in a room for, you know, for their stay or an apartment. They'll be rooming with other artists also. So there'd be a sense of like apprenticeship or camaraderie there, where they get to know each other. They'll come in and they can work in the studio in the museum. They'll be able to have their own classes there, private classes there. We'll probably do some online stuff together, also streams together, where we're just going to try to broadcast, this knowledge out to the community.
We feel that we should be a part of developing an audience, because if we don't develop our audience, and I think you and I have talked about this before, about developing audiences, because if we don't develop an audience, what are we doing this for? If we have no audience to look at the art or participate creating the art, you know, what are we doing? So we feel strongly about educating and showing and sharing techniques. People are really, really wanting to learn how to make their figures look attractive. And with the programs that David and Gary have been talking about, we can bring these people here and let the public see that it's achievable. It's an achievable goal to improve your painting skills or your sculpting skills or your diorama skills. We want to cover it all.
Yeah.
And so we'll have eventually, we're hoping to have, where you can do a subscription to the classes in streaming and stuff like that. So we're going to try to do it all. I mean, it is very ambitious, but honestly, in this day and age, it is not impossible to do all the things that we want to do.
Well, this weekend, just yesterday, we had our regular paint club meeting. We do that once a month for the locals and anybody else who wants to drive out to Las Vegas. But we had Michael Contreras and Fabrizio.
Right.
This weekend, and they did it. Non grata. They
didn't charge. They came in and did demonstrations, and anyone that was walking by the museum could have come in and observed.
Yeah, and we have one more next month. Actually, two more next month.
Yes.
And do you want to?
Well, we have a couple of the Greek gentlemen, Alexandros Hesapis and Christos Panagiopoulos, who will be at MFCA this year. They're going to follow me home from the show, and then they're going to be here for 2 weeks, and they'll be doing something similar.
Wow.
One weekend they're going to have a painting class, and then the next weekend they'll do a sculpting class.
That's great.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty nice. And their group, their company that they have formed, Bobo Rhino, they have a mission statement to reach out to the public, because they feel the same way that I do about developing audience. They want to reach out and offer opportunities as best as they can for the regular guy that maybe doesn't, doesn't have a lot of money to spend on classes. Because honestly, you can spend a lot of money on these classes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and paints and figures and Windsor and Newton series sevens. And
we want to make it achievable for people, for just the regular person to be able to join in and have a good time with us.
Yeah. For example, we have that young fellow that'll be joining in on Eric Swinson's class.
Yes,
we secured a spot for.
Yes, we're going to do like scholarship type things where we offer scholarships for young people from time to time.
Yeah, so for this class, we only offer 12 seats, but we set aside the 13th seat
for our scholarships.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is a conversation that I've been having forever with Joe Burton, the president of the Military Ministry Society of Illinois. His wife, David, is the curator of European art at the Art Institute of Chicago. So she is forever flying to Paris to arrange a trade with the Louvre or Orangerie. We'll give you the Van Gogh for 2 months and we'll take your Picasso, right? And You know, it has always rankled Joe, who spent his career as a middle school art teacher, that we have made no inroads, really, our hobby, into the world of fine art galleries, much less museums. Before MFCA, Penny, I'm going with Joe to fix the three box dioramas that are in the paint workshop that where Andrew Wyeth did all of his work that he had purchased from Shep Payne. And the lights have burned out again. So we go in, we fix it up in the museum back room. But aside from odd little things like that or the short-lived museum in Missouri, we haven't had someone brave enough to step forward and kind enough as a patron to say, hey, this is art. Let us celebrate it as art. Better than a gallery in a museum. How do yes. you guys, you're also talking, so when you say broaden the audience, that's part of what I'm hearing, Penny.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And it's not just, I mean, for the community, it's a museum, but for the general public, it's an attraction. Mm-hmm. And so we want to attract the masses. There's not a out of family-friendly options in Las Vegas, we want to be one of the destinations that people consider to bring their kids to to see this stuff, and that's where we grow things yeah. because you know when many of those people when they walk through that gallery and they see the work that's presented before them and what's possible, they're going to walk right out with models and paints and brushes and.
And come back the next weekend for a class.
And then come back for a class.
Yeah,
as if they're local.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, for us, that's how we grow things.
Yeah.
It's not.
Gary is an excessively smart man. And so he knows that this whole situation needs to be set up to where it can go on for a long time. So, we're going to try to avoid what happened in Missouri. Mm-hmm. And with his genius in being able to figure those sorts of things out, I have every confidence that this will last into perpetuity if we let it happen. So, and that was something that one of the first conversations I had with him is like, stuff happens. So what happens if you're not here? Is this going to continue? And he has guaranteed me that this will continue for a long time.
Well, I want to ask a question about that. I don't want to embarrass Gary, but he is a Gandalf looking dude.
Saruman.
Did he discover and finally solve turning lead into gold? Is that where is that how he is able to make this happen?
I would think so. Yeah, absolutely. Yep, he has figured out how to do that. He has a very good mind with the financial world. So he has done very well with that, and we're very, very grateful to have him as a patron. And he's a fine gentleman. I enjoy just being here with him because he's so smart, and we have a lot of fun with our conversations.
Wonderful stories.
Yeah, the three of us and then Gary's assistant Whitley, the four of us are, I feel, one of the best working teams that I have ever experienced, and I really appreciate it. I mean, you know, I'm no spring chicken, and I thought, well, my working experiences that I've had, that's it. That's my impression of working life. But no, this is so great. We enjoy each other's companies. We respect each other's opinions. When we have a problem, we get together, we discuss it, and we solve it. And that is so unique in the working world.
Yeah. Yeah. What is the division of labor? Have you guys got titles?
Jack of all trades.
Right? Yeah, we're all wearing all the hats.
Yeah, so, like, I do everything from artist liaison to cleaning the toilets. So, and I'm very proud of it.
Well, I saw you posting on Facebook that you were unboxing a Balrog. And the reason I asked about the diorama being life size, that box was about 8 feet long, Penny.
That piece Gary purchased, I think, is that a Queen Studio one? Yeah. And that's a 1-to-1. That's a 1-to-1 scale Balrog.
Okay.
So I'll post the pictures of the actual, because that was. David and I talked about it this morning. We were actually grateful that we had all those people there yesterday, because he and I, we could have done that ourselves, but it would have taken a couple of days with all the gentlemen that were there. And, you know, and so they rolled up their sleeves and got that thing done. And I'm telling you, it was quite an endeavor to move that thing around the museum and get it put into a place. So we were really grateful that all those people threw in their hands.
I think I saw you on the electric drill taking out about 400 screws there, David.
Yeah, well, that was... We did three unboxings yesterday. One was in cardboard boxes, and then two, the one that I posted of David and Screen. What was that little diorama? That little,
I honestly, it was like still not all together, but it's basically a little fantasy, like medieval town scene.
Yeah.
A fantasy medieval town. It's got like the worm, drunken worm inn, and the, yeah.
So, you know, we get these boxes and it's like, what's in the box?
It's a hard job, but, you know, someone's got to
do it. Yeah.
Every day is Christmas. Yeah.
Yeah. We had a lot of fun yesterday. And with all the people that were there, I think it was really, you know, people like watching unboxing and, you know, breaking Easter eggs and all of that. So it was really fun for everybody there, because like a lot of people were out in the room painting, because it's studio time for them. But as soon as we started going for the Balrog, everybody was up and like helping move it, you know, and all of that. So it was really a fun day. It was an absolutely fun day.
And Penny and I were very thankful to the Paint Club for being there for that, because like and Michael and Fabrizio, because like all we had to do was just peel the boxes out, and they basically all took over, and I was able to just step back and watch it happen. It was amazing.
It was funny, because it was like, as soon as we started undoing the screws and stuff like that, people were swarming. It was like, okay, we'll step back and let this happen.
It was great.
And I liked it a lot.
Well, I've been dominating the questioning because we wanted to make sure we got you both sharing one mic, okay? But Barry, is there? You've got to have some great things to ask as well.
I have a couple questions. First off, give us an idea of the schedule of when you expect the full opening. If you have that, if not, that's fine.
So there's multiple openings happening. So in July. Hopefully by end of July, we'll actually get the keys to the museum building. That's when all the drywall and everything's up. The walls are painted. The floors are bare. And we got an empty building, not just with a dirt floor. Hmm. And so our first step is actually going to be developing the first floor, probably starting with the storefront and creating an online store as well. And then also furnishing the studio space. But we have a ton of theme work to do, because we have the two themed game rooms and we have the 3,000 square foot walkthrough diorama.
Oh, describe the two game rooms.
Yeah. So the one game room will be kind of like your Prancing Pony-esque style game room. And the other one will be more of a dwarven grotto. So it'll be really neat, and we don't know exactly how we're going to offer these spaces for people to play in, but what we'd like to have is like the ability for people to plan a trip for the whole gaming group to come out and use these spaces.
I was going to say before that, when you were talking about housing some artists in residency, it'd be really disappointing if you don't make them dungeon themed rooms.
All right.
Well, I think the original idea was a castle on the hill.
Right. Oh,
Fantastic.
But so to get back to the original questions, that's going to take a long time. We hope to get the storefront open by the end of this year. We're hoping to do kind of a soft opening of the first floor with the gallery space, the studio space, the storefront, and hopefully maybe even the two game rooms by the end of summer 2025, if not the end of the year 2025.
Yeah, 2025. Mm-hmm. Year. Yeah, that's what I think is it's going to be a year to, you know, to get things in order.
And actually, as we are developing the walkthrough diorama, we may even offer tours up to see the work in progress. It's the most, it's going to be the most ultimate work in progress there ever was. And if we can, I hope that it's the largest collaborative project among in our community ever, because I would really like to have many artists come in and help with this.
I promised to turn it over to Barry, but I don't want to let this question slip by. One of the things I've talked to Joe Burton's wife, Gloria, about is the special expertise in museum lighting. All right. There are like PhDs in this, right, who just concentrate on how to make that Magritte look as good as possible on the wall of the Art Institute, right? So I imagine you guys are having an education in how do we illuminate all of these incredible pieces.
Right, yeah. And, but, you know, so that there's a difference between illuminating a canvas on a wall and illuminating a three-dimensional object.
Of course,
that,
yeah.
That has, you know, especially in the fantasy realm, we often have saturated shadows and these things that, where you can't just put a, you know, a 45 degree angle light source away for, or whatever, you know. So we will be, when it comes to how the museum itself is managed and how the exhibition space is managed, we really do hope to have qualified personnel on top of that. And it'd be great if those individuals were in the hobby community already.
Yeah.
Because it would have that understanding that this is not just lighting for a canvas on a wall.
Right.
This is something else entirely. Yeah. This is it's our form of art is a little bit different than the 2D side.
Yeah, but not so different, David, than how do you make the Rodin look
sure,
good.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's smaller, except for the Balrog.
There are challenges, and we fully expect that we will have professional consultation on the design of the cabinetry and how we display the pieces because of what we're talking about.
Yeah, Penny. I mean, number one gripe we hear at shows is the lights.
Yeah, I was going to say it'll be far from a ballroom experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have, these are just ideas that we're throwing around, but we would even like to have like little boom arms with magnifying, so you can actually move them around and look at the different miniatures, especially for the small scale stuff, you know, but how we implement all that and everything is going to be very difficult. And then also just the curation of the entire collection is... And how are we going to rotate pieces in? How will we archive and all these things?
Difficult, but fun. It all sounds like enormously fun challenges to me. But Barry, what else did you want to ask?
Just to let you know the task at hand. There's 16,000, over 16,000 miniatures in the collection right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to design the experience of like what he was saying, you know, what goes on display, how are we going to store things, et cetera, et cetera. So it is every aspect of the museum, no matter where you look. If you turn and look in one direction, we have the diorama. That is a daunting task. The museum itself, it's a daunting task. Getting the teachings, et cetera. So it sometimes can be a little overwhelming, but again, I feel we have right now the best team to get it rolling, and we have good judgment on bringing proper individuals in to help us.
So just one last question I wanted to ask is about the store. You said that there's going to be a store at the actual museum that you can walk in and buy things and online component. What kind of stuff are you going to sell? Is it just mostly miniatures or?
Well, it's not going to be your typical gaming store. That's for sure. So like, cause there's many gaming stores in Las Vegas already. Mm-hmm. All of them are very sufficient in what they offer people. But as an attraction for figure art in general, we basically want to supply all the studio materials necessary for figure art, including the figures themselves, possibly even 3D printed figures, which are a little bit harder for a lot of people to come by if they don't want to mess with the resin printing and all that has to offer the human biome. But the goal here is to be able to provide anything from lights for your desk all the way to the brush in your hand. We want to represent the producers of our supplies that we love in our community as much as we want to represent the artists in the museum. So we would like to have paints from multiple different carriers, producers, for example, just because, you know, there's a lot of people when they come there, they're going to want to see that color of the paints that they use, right? And we're all different. We all like different paints for different reasons. And sometimes we like different paints all together. So we need them all. But we just want to make sure that the producers are also represented in the same way, because they're very much a part of the evolution of the figure painting community.
Great. Well, and you guys definitely have to talk to Joe Burton at some point, because he and I have done a presentation at museums here in Chicago about the history of toy soldiers, for lack of a better word. And to have one history that incorporates how we got from Josiane Desfontaines to Costas Karyotelis all in the same world, it's a fascinating story, and it just doesn't get told.
Right. And that's kind of one of my missions, is to, at various points in time, to have special exhibitions that will tell that story.
Yeah.
Where we can borrow things from people's collections that are, you know, when I use the word historical, it's hard to differentiate from a historical figure or a historical figure, if that makes sense.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
The pieces that certain people did that broadened our horizons at certain periods of time. I the difference between, old toy soldiers, which were flat at one point in time with a little foot on them, to the evolution of some of these spectacular fantasy figures that we have today. So
yeah, your first love, Penny, from flats to rounds to
I was sharing some flats yesterday with some of the people that had come to the function yesterday, and they had no idea. I shared a set of I picked a set that were somewhat fantasy, in that I was showing off the Alice in Wonderland flats that I just acquired, and they had no idea. They were fascinated by it. And I said, well, you know, when you stop and think about it, or if you did the research and looked it up, toy soldiers were flat. And you see that in that movie where, Mel Gibson needs to make a lead shot for his gun, and he takes a flat footed figure and melts it down and makes a lead ball for his gun.
Yeah.
And,
which was totally accurate to this.
Completely historically perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is an illustration that I use to people to show that flat figures have been around for a long time, and then they evolved into standing foot figures like what we've had for many centuries now.
This is actually one of our ideas for our lobby space also, is to show off some of the history of miniatures in general.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, it's hard to offer so much space for that, because there's an entire history before now.
Right.
But you know, there's, to see how it has developed over the years would be really neat.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you guys. It's so exciting what you're doing. I'm glad we got the scoop on it. And man, I'm ready. It takes a lot to get me to go to Vegas. You know, I was there once. I talked at the Las Vegas Book Fair when one of my books came out. And man, I got kicked out of the Bellagio because I was underdressed. I was underdressed. I was there in like shorts and a very nice dress shirt. I had just been on Vegas public television being interviewed. So I wasn't dressed like a bum. And then my wife and I went to go to dinner and it's like, sir, there's a dress code. And like, meanwhile, like half naked people are walking by. I'm like, they didn't like the looks of me.
Well, that was your problem right there, sir.
I think it's
I should have been naked. I should have.
I think it's funny that you're the only person I know that's been kicked out of the Bellagio.
I know. I'm
sorry, but all the people that I know, I would not have guessed it would have been you.
I wouldn't. But, you know, Carmel, while I was arguing with the maitre d', Carmel went and put $1 in the machine and she won $200. And so we went to dinner somewhere else.
Right there, right? So you can put the suit on.
Exactly.
Take their $200 and go spend it somewhere else.
Do you there have you any questions? Barry, did you get your question in that you wanted to ask?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Make sure that you're covered there.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, I would love for you to. Barry has seen the collection in its current iteration here at Gary's house. And it is an experience that is, you know, I would love for you to happen. So if you ever do come to Vegas in the near future, please let us know, because I would like to introduce you in the person of to Gary and see the collection as it stands right now and why he had to build a museum.
Yeah. I was somewhere around Barstow on the edge of the desert when the drugs began to take me to Virgo's Vault.
So, actually, further down the line, especially when we get close to the opening, it would be great to have you guys out and do a live in.
Absolutely. Cool. Absolutely. Yeah. We're going to make Gary tell us the secret of lead to gold.
Absolutely. He'll be here.
Yeah.
And I'm actually going to be there in July, I think, because I believe I scored a seat in Eric's class.
Oh, in July, so,
guy.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah, I really wanted to take that class too, but I'm going to be over in Europe at that time. So
I'll be there. And we actually, that class sold out so fast that I just put it out there. I was like, any chance you want to do another one the following weekend? And he was like, well, I just have to have a space to work. I'm like, well, gee. We can make that.
You know? Is it, David, are you guys going to get to the point where you don't have teachers with beards?
It's possible. We're going to.
I'm having trouble growing a beard. And I was thinking of having a class.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, no, it's a prerequisite. Sorry.
All right. Okay. Well, we got to work on it, Barry.
We went out to dinner we had a couple of artists from Europe over and we all went out to dinner and I literally was the only one at the table that didn't have a long beard. And the waiter actually commented, he came up and he said, so is this a club where you have to have a beard? You
know. Yep. Well, beards rock, beard rock. All right. Thank you. Thank you so much, David and Penny and Gary, for allowing you guys to chat. And we can't wait to talk to him down the line. Thank you, Gary.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to share what we're working on.
And you betcha.
If we have particular announcements that we want to make, you know, and we need a vehicle, we'll definitely be in contact.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot, guys.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a great
day.
Thank
you so much.
All right. Thank you, Penny Meyer and David Higgins, and in the background, Gary Sparks. I really do think this is going to be an important step forward for our hobby. Like I said in the chat, Barry, to finally get some recognition for the art of miniatures as exactly that, art.
I think it's going to be a huge game changer. And as I've said before, it's interesting that it's not much happens in this part of the country as far as miniatures, and now all of a sudden it'll be one of the centers of the hobby.
Yeah, for the world, really.
Yep. A 6-hour drive from me, so that's pretty cool.
But you don't much like to drive.
I don't
like road trips.
Okay, it's an hour and 15-minute flight. So
okay,
there you go.
All right, there you go.
Yeah.
You know, so in to round out this episode, in my ongoing series of Edumacate Jim questions for Barry, I'm having a huge amount of frustration, you know, with my airbrush, as I always do. I've basically mastered the ability to paint a vehicle or scenery one color. Mm-hmm. But I have a really hard time, Mr. Biedeker, with shading in. A lot of what we do on box dioramas is if we have some groundwork, for example, that fades into black of night with black velvet or some other light-killing fabric in the background. You know, and if I want to, like gradiate, you know, from black to lighter gray in the center, I just always, whatever I'm doing, the dark color or the light color, I wind up getting one color.
Mm-hmm. So you're asking how to paint something black, and I'm going to say what Shep would say. Paint it black.
Use black paint. Yeah, no, I know. Yep. you took too much pride in using that well-worn chef. How do you paint grass green? You use green paint. Yeah, I know. I'm talking about fading. I'm talking about pre-shading and post-shading, as our plastic brethren and sistren call it. I can never get the airbrush to do gradients of color.
So when you're talking about post-shading, you're talking about, it seems like you're talking about two different things. You're talking about fading one color into another, and post-shading is usually, to me, more like adding texture and shading in specific areas on a model. Which are we talking about?
I'm talking about groundwork, or I sent you a photo of my Zeppelin gondola canopy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I painted it, airbrushed it, a medium gray, and then I used a very light gray for the curve, because it's a curved gondola, right? The top of the roof, the middle of mm-hmm. the roof. And instead, I just got all one color gray.
Yeah. Well,
so, you know, I'm it seems like whatever color is in my airbrush, that's the color of the whole damn thing.
Well, it's there's a couple things that, I mean, it's hard to, for me to say from the picture what's going on, but I actually see some lines on there, but I don't know if those are shadows. They look like shadows, maybe.
No. They were kind of sculpted in. I mean, I used a particular light tissue paper, several layers, yeah. and put it over the architecture of the gondola.
Oh, yeah. No, so, I see those, but I think I'm just seeing some shadows in that box.
Yeah, probably shadows of the, yeah.
So there's a couple different, well, first off, what kind of paint are you using?
Tamiya.
Okay. And Tamiya is one of those paints where you can thin it down to almost nothing. It still sprays okay.
Yeah, I use a lot of their thinner. And
the lacquer thinner.
No, I use the regular airbrush
thinner. The X20A.
Thinner.
Okay. Yeah. For things like this, that should work fine, I would imagine. But you've got, I mean, basically what it looks to me like is that you just didn't use enough contrast. You didn't use a light enough color to bump it up. There's not enough difference between the two colors.
Right.
You got to go way lighter a lot of times than you ever think you will. You would want to make it work out. Yeah, it looks to me like you have not used enough contrast between the two colors. I think that's the main thing. I don't know how big a spray pattern were you using when you're airbrushing it. Like,
well, this is part of my problem. No matter how I turn the screw at the end of my Grex, I seem to get the same width of line.
Wait a minute. Hold on. So when you turn what part? I'm not really familiar with the Grex, but...
Well, you know, the airbrush has at the end of it, at the not opposite the nozzle end. There's
the tail end. Okay. You have the limiter. So what all that does is it just limits how far you can. It's a double action airbrush, right?
Yeah.
So you pull back. All that does is limit the travel. So it just makes the biggest line. It sets basically the biggest line that's possible.
Ah. Right? I get a big line. I'm good at big surfaces.
Okay, but you've got to practice with how far you pull the trigger back. So you push down to get air, you pull the trigger back to open up the nozzle, and as you open up the nozzle, basically the pattern becomes bigger.
Ah.
Right?
So I just am always pulling the trigger too far back.
Yeah, but you can use that tail limiter. I don't use that limiter on the back much at all, but you can screw that down so that you can only pull it back a little bit. And you'll see, if you screw it in enough, you'll see that it limits the travel of that trigger enough to where you're just going to get a little, the smallest line possible eventually.
Well, here's my current challenge. So I've got the City of London in super mini scale, and you were very kind in 3D printing out for me St. Paul's Cathedral and a couple of blocks surrounding it, and mm-hmm. the rest of it I'm scratch building, right? So it's 13 inches wide and a foot deep, and so it's a lot of surface to cover. And I want it to be at night. I pulled this off on my Lancaster diorama with an unnamed German city that the Lancaster was flying over, about to bomb, mm-hmm. right? And, yeah. I tried to play with it there, fading the edges of the base to black, and I got all one color. I got all rather dark gray. And then I highlighted a bit with oils, dry brushing a little very light gray to the some buildings to make them pop, and oil wash of a black or a dark umber on the side. I went back to the brush.
Right. Well, how big of an area are we talking about that you're fading over?
Well, maybe an inch and a half on three sides of the base.
Okay. So you wanted it, it was a light gray, and you wanted to fade it to black over a couple inches, basically.
Right. And I want to do the same thing now, when I'd like to actually master it on the airbrush as opposed to having to go back and cheat with the oil washes and dry brushing.
It's a perfect use of the airbrush, right? So
it should be, according to the things I see, but I've never been able to do it.
From what I'm seeing, the first step is, like I said, you need to make your, if you start with a light gray and you're going to fade the edges, you need to start with pure black. So just use pure black to fade, right?
Mm.
And then you also need to make it so that you are, your line is, small enough to where it makes that happen. I would have to see you spraying to give you any more detail information about any of that, but maybe we should get on a Zoom call and actually have you spray.
Oh yeah, and then we could put it on. We could do a tutorial, airbrushing for idiots,
or not to do
airbrushing for an idiot. Yeah. You far more skillful at it than me.
Well, I think it's probably a matter of understanding how it works and some practice, because it sounds like you haven't been using the double action trigger properly.
Yeah, that
does basically sound true. Just been pulling it all the way back, which basically is you can still hit the edge of your spray pattern along the edge even if you pull it back all the way, but you're still wasting a lot of paint.
Yeah, so it's not like a spray can.
You can do the same thing with a spray can. It's not much control, but
that's it. I'm lacking control.
Okay.
All right. Okay. All right. I'm going to, maybe that's a good idea. I can do it. Carmel can have the iPhone over my shoulder. I'll give her the respirator and that you made me buy. And I want to get this skill mastered.
Yeah. No, it's a worthwhile skill. I think you still have the issue also that you're not using contrasting enough paint.
Yeah, it's probably both.
Yeah, because what you showed me, it looks like one color.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. That's my problem.
Yeah.
Whenever I try to do some blending with the airbrush, I get one color.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think it's a matter of practice. And it takes quite a bit of practice to become good at the airbrush, really.
Yeah, see, I don't use it often enough. It's rare that I'm painting a big enough piece of scenery or a vehicle you know, and even then, when you do a vehicle, I've never bothered with that post and pre-shading and the top. I've tried to get like the top of a vehicle lighter, and then that all gets to be one color too. So in the end, I go in with the handheld paintbrush.
Right. That's what it's useful for. So, and also there's camouflage patterns. If there's all kinds of cool camouflage patterns, if you become really good at the airbrush.
I know. I got that para wax stuff you gave me, parafilm.
In most cases, that's not going to be too useful to mask a.
Well, I've used the silly putty too. I got halfway decent camouflage on my Lancaster.
I'm talking about freehanding. If you practice enough, you can freehand camouflage. Yeah. But the first step is learning how the trigger works. That's what I would say.
All right. Step one. All right. And step two, learn to use more contrast.
Yeah. There is a guy who does art on paper with an airbrush who does, I think, probably the best how-tos for airbrushing, at least that I've seen. And I don't want to come across as some airbrushing expert. There are modelers who are far beyond what I do with an airbrush.
Oh, I know. I see what Will Pattison, our buddy, does, and I'm like, oh my God, that's superhuman.
Yeah. No, but all it takes is some practice. But one thing you have to, speaking of the paper painters, the artists who paint on, you know, art paper, one thing you have to be careful of is that what they're spraying on being absorbent will completely change how the paint acts. So it's good for general techniques. Like this one video I'm thinking of, the guy actually shows you exactly how you should use the trigger, the best way to use the trigger. And it's useful for that, but you just can't practice on paper and then go to plastic and think it's going to act the same.
Yeah. It's not. What's this guy's name?
to find it.
Okay, we'll put it in the blog.
Yeah, we will.
All right. The Rocky Mountain Show. We talked about it only once so far. Coming up in June. First time. Yep. So give us the lowdown again.
Yeah, so it's June 22nd. It's going to be in West Jordan, Utah, which is a suburb of Salt Lake City. It's about a 15-minute drive from downtown Salt Lake or something like that. It is at our, I said last time it was the Air Guard. It is not the Air Guard. It's our Army National Guard aviation unit. Mm. So they fly Apaches and Blackhawks. And it's at the airport there. It's a really cool facility, large, well-lit. And we're going to have, I said last time it was going to be partly amps, partly open. And we've changed it since then. It's going to be fully open show, open judging method. And we've simplified it, and we're thinking it's probably going to be one category. Whereas like Chicago and most of our other shows have six categories. And the main reason for that is to split it down in so that judging teams know what they're looking at. But we have a system down we think is going to work. And the big thing I think people need to remember with this show is that this is our first show. We're seeing what works for us. We mostly want people to come out and just have a good time. That's the main thing. But we're, I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be fun.
I think it's great that you guys are taking this on. And you're going to be the head judge, and I know stress comes with that, and you're also working on some of the back end and the website, right, and the registration, all that.
Yeah. So we're going to have some online registration, and again, being a single category show, and the way that works might confuse people, but basically we're going to have it. So you bring your stuff in, a team of judges picks what is going to likely get you the highest award possible out of your collection. It then goes to another team that looks in detail at that piece and then decides what level of award it warrants.
Okay. All right. So
does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. At MFCA, which is coming up in a couple of weeks, we'll talk about that just a little. You know, the team goes down and judges fantasy open, fantasy painters, historical open, historical painters, ordnance open, ordnance painters. Painter's categories are just for the finish of the model, really. The open include scratch building, conversions, original sculpted figures, so on. So I come in with a Warhammer Dwarf and a Sherman Firefly and Napoleon on a horse. And your first team of judges is going to say, wow, that's the best Napoleon on a horse I've ever seen. That's going to get him the best award. We're going to judge this one. Then they hand it over to the team that's handling your historical painters, let's say, what would have been. And they'll say whether it's a certificate, a bronze, a silver, or a gold.
Right, exactly. So the piece will be judged based on what it is. So if it's a scratch-built tank, it'll be judged as a scratch-built tank. If it's a stock Tamiya kit, it'll be judged as a painter's entry would be at a regular open show.
Right, and I can go home knowing, I showed my Dwarf, I showed my Napoleon, I showed my Firefly, and, you know, Napoleon, they thought, the judges thought, was the best I had to show.
Yep. Yep. Right. So you get the feedback that way from a group of judges, respected people.
Yeah. And then I meet new friends and they all get to see everything I brought.
Right. And I think one of my favorite things about this concept is that when you bring your entries and put them on the table, they are all in one place.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have to play that game where it's like, oh, well, my airplane's over there, my figures are over here, my tank's over there. You get to see what that person did.
This is the Jim D. Regatta space.
Yep.
All right.
Yep.
But we will have no Barry Bediger space.
Well, the judges, we are planning on having in a case somewhere, possibly out in the front part of the hall, some work from all of the judges.
Oh, good. Good.
At least one piece. You know, so there's an idea of what, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Shep would be proud of you. You're trying to educate a new group of modelers in the way the open system works.
Yeah.
And that's tough, but it's also, it's going to pay off, Barry.
It is tough, and I'm hopefully, and it shows signs of doing this already, but hopefully simplifying the categories even more makes that first step a little bit easier of communicating how it works.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It might seem like it wouldn't, but when you start talking about open and painters and ordnance and historical fantasy, that makes perfect sense to us. But a lot of people, when I tell them about that stuff, they're just like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
No, I've seen people short themselves that they did more work enough to qualify for the open, but they didn't think they did because it wasn't 100% sculpted. So they enter it in painters. Yeah. And vice versa. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I've seen so people claim, you know, I moved a finger, so now I'm in open, right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So it's going to be important on our forms that the people list what they've done, if they've done any conversion or detailing in that, which is always important in any show, but this will determine how it is looked at and how it's judged in part.
All right. What I meant when I asked there's going to be no Barry Bediger there, I mean, you're not working on anything to bring new to show at Rocky Mountain in June 22nd, or at MFCA, right?
Well,
MFCA
at MFCA
is coming up quick, May 3rd and 4th.
Yep, that's right. I thought I was going to work on a box, but I decided I don't want to rush something like that. But I will have at least one bust there.
Oh, good.
Possibly two, but at least one.
Oh, good.
So,
all right.
Yeah.
All right, that's exciting. I got a box I finished a while ago, so I'm looking forward to showing that.
And Joan, I mean, she's right on track for having a little mini box diorama done for MFCA.
I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled about everything I've heard about it, and it's always good to see anything Joan produces, but it's going to be her first box, so that's especially exciting.
She's had a great time, and I was showing her how to solder stuff yesterday.
Ooh.
And she picked up on that and loves it. She just is having a great time doing it and making the LED mounts.
Mm-hmm.
I show her how I did mine, and she loves that. And so she's just
off and running.
She's taking and running with it, yeah.
Well, I should ask her how to airbrush.
Maybe so. Probably get a better answer. You know what the true answer to your airbrush question is?
Practice.
I should say this. No, not just that. I did not learn how to airbrush well until I had a friend of mine who was an expert at airbrushing take me over to his house, sit me down, and show me how he actually did it, just right there, one-on-one. That you really need something like that.
I did. I got that from the late, great Mike Cobb.
Mm.
And I loved Mike, so did you. He was president for life of the MMSI until he passed. And then, you know, and Mike had one of them super-duper auto mechanic air pumps in his garage.
Yeah.
So we sat on his back porch and he ran the airbrush hose, you know, like 50 feet through the backyard to the garage. Yeah. And yeah. We sat there with our Dixie cups and our paint mixes and our thinners. And that got me to step one. I can make the Tamiya tan plastic all olive green. Something.
It's just a matter of the next step. And you do. It does really help to have somebody show you. What wasn't I going to do that once when I came out there to Chicago? I can't remember what happened.
Well, you often say, when I come, I'll do this, that, and the other thing. And you're going to give me a soldering tutorial and an airbrush tutorial and a this. But then instead you, I don't know, sit and play on your iPod.
Is that what I do?
Well, no.
It seems like there's just less time than I think there's going to be.
There's never enough time. And that's why for several years I tried to talk you into moving to Chicago. And that's gone nowhere. Well, all right. I'm glad to have given the world the scoop on Verco's vault. This is obviously a story we'll stay on top of, as we say in the biz. And I appreciate your airbrush advice. I just have to sit down and fill the biggest cup with paint. And play with it. Play with the trigger. Play with the limiter.
I'll send you links to these videos I was talking about, and it might help you.
And we'll put it all on the blog along with some fun pictures of Verco's vault. You and I will be there trailing in the shadow of first-time award-winning, I'm certain, box diorama builder Joan Biediger. But if you know, hopefully people stop and chat with us.
Yeah, hope so.
All right. Thanks, Barry.
Thank you. We'll see you next time.
We love hearing from you, our listeners. Here's some recent messages.
Barry, how you doing? I'm trying to achieve Pat Vest status, and I'm hoping I called you just at the wrong time. So anyway, Nothing urgent. I just was listening to one of the podcasts and thinking, you know, I should call Barry and Jim and tell them how much fun these are. So that's it. Don't have to call me back, but I guess I'll see you at MFCA. Anyway, talk soon. If you get a chance, give me a buzz. But otherwise, I'll see you in a couple of weeks, hopefully. All right, take care.